Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Listeners, before we get started, I've got a quick favor to ask of you. We're trying to make this podcast as best as it can be, and we want you to fill out just a real quick survey for us. So if you check the episode notes wherever you get this podcast, or go to our website at www.trickledownsocialism.com and click the link to the survey. We've got just 5 questions for you to fill out to help us understand what it is that you like about the show, what you might change about the show, and kind of what we need to do to make this podcast as good as it can be. So please go ahead and check out this survey link in the episode notes or on our website. Thank you.
Started by this one guy named Clint Borgen. He realized in his travels abroad, he was volunteering in Kosovo when a genocide broke out over there. And he realized how little really the United States government is doing in terms of helping out the global poor. When you look at how much wealth and resources the United States has, we're the richest country in the world, and we have the best capability of dealing with global poverty. And so really, he saw that, and he wanted to make an emphasis on U.S. foreign policy, in particularly focusing on global poverty. So that involves things like educating, mobilizing, creating things like infographics that have information about bills that we're trying to pass, to send to influencers and to regular people, just to kind of get the word out. There's various strategies that we can implement to reduce global poverty, but really it comes down to making it a focus of the U.S. government.
Cool. So folks, if you're hearing a new voice on the pod, we have Dan and C Money as usual, but we also have Jordan Barney of the 805 Uncensored podcast, who's just introducing a really cool group that he works with called the Borgen Project. But also give us a quick rundown on what you talk about mainly on the 805 Uncensored.
Yeah, so 805 Uncensored podcast is focused on all things leftism, whether it's healthcare, whether it's reducing poverty, whether it's basically the podcast is about leftist revolutionary activity. We also cover things that are not politics, like spirituality, music. It's an anti-establishment podcast, very much anti-corporate media.
On this episode, we're going to feature an interview with Lauren Hubbard, who is running for U.S. Congress in California's 22nd district, which to the average listener might not mean much, but there is a certain someone who occupies that seat right now, and he likes to sue fake accounts on Twitter. That is Devin Nunes. So, you know, in terms of the California 22nd district, I know you don't live in the Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, which is the main portion of that district, but what is your sense of Devin Nunes and how he's been in office for as long as he has? What do you think it is that the voters see in him? Like, who is he speaking to? Who does he really represent?
It's really important to note that California is extremely diverse. So we have 40 million people in our state. We could easily be multiple states. The Central Valley in particular is more rural, more conservative. It's an agricultural area. And it's much different culturally speaking than like San Francisco or Los Angeles. With Devin Nunes, I know that he started out as a dairy farmer, but really, at least looking at his politics since 2016, 2017, this guy's nothing but a right-wing hack. Doesn't care about anything but advancing his own political interests and other Republicans around him. He is known for shutting his office to constituents. He's been known to call police on them. He frequently locks his office doors. He was obviously heavily involved in the Russia investigation with the dossier CA stuff, a bunch of really sketchy stuff related to that. I listed a few really terrible takes that Devin Nunes has listed over the years for a variety of subjects.
Yeah, let's go ahead and sample some of those.
Okay, so I'll start with the environment. In February of 2014, while California was in its worst drought since at least the 70s, Nunes rejected any link to climate change, claiming global warming is nonsense. And if that wasn't bad enough, he took it and blamed the drought on the Endangered Species Act. He said it was a man-made drought due to water restrictions from the Endangered Species Act of 73 and other environmental regulations that have seen water allocations decline dramatically even in non-drought years. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Moving on to immigration and refugees. Nunes supported the 2017 executive order by Trump imposing a temporary ban on entry into the United States by citizens of seven Muslim-majority countries, also known as the Muslim ban, and said it was a common-sense security measure to prevent future terrorist attacks on the homeland. So, you know, just open xenophobia, open racism.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of take is what gets me because of how immigrant heavy his district is. Like, he just doesn't care.
He just doesn't care.
Wow.
All right. So, okay. January 2019, Congress passed a bill that Nunes supported, which extended Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, also known as the FISA, until 2023. And Trump signed it into law that month. So what that did was that allowed the National Security Agency to conduct searches of foreigners' communications completely without warrants. Ugh. And that process incidentally collects information from Americans as well. Nunes then lauded the bill, saying the House of Representatives has taken a big step to ensure the continuation of one of the intelligence community's most vital tools for tracking foreign terrorists.
I mean, what happened to the strain of right-wing folks who stood up for personal freedom?
Anti-big government.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're just straight up authoritarians now.
Yeah.
Okay, and then moving on to COVID, on March 15th, 2020, amid the COVID pandemic, Nunes encouraged families who were quote unquote healthy to go out and go to a local restaurant. Likely you can get in easy. I mean, he probably wasn't wrong on that last point that you could get in easy, but there's a reason for that. On March 17, 2020, Nunes told Laura Ingraham on Fox News that the media was exaggerating COVID. He predicted that the crisis would be over by Easter. There's a good chance we can get through this in the next couple of weeks, and for sure by Easter, because we'll have a handle on who's getting sick and how to treat them. And then on March 31st, 2 weeks later, after California decided to close schools to stop the spread, he called that way overkill.
Yeah, so my question is, like, what does this dude do for the Central Valley, like the people that he represents?
I don't understand why this guy's been able to stay in office for so long because of how little he does represent his constituents.
I mean, it does seem like there's been a lack of a viable candidate, and I do think that Lauren Hubbard is on to some things. Like, you know, he mentioned just conversations he's had with constituents, and I think he's really well equipped to have those conversations. You know, we'll hear him later in this episode, but he grew up with a conservative background. You know, he kind of was a Republican. And so I think he speaks the language, and he's going to be able to get into conversations with folks and really drill down and say, like, what has he done? You know, what has he done to improve your life? And I think his, you know, being fiscally conservative and his way of kind of leveraging that to talk about programs like Medicare for All that are, in fact, much more efficient with money than our current healthcare system. But I do think that getting some conversations with voters and saying, like, what has changed, you know, net positive for you since he's been your representative, I think that that'll go a long way. So I did have one other question for you, and this is because I have read a few times about the recall effort to get Gavin Newsom out of the governorship in California, but I kind of want to get a sense from someone who lives in California and tracks California politics, like, what's going on there? You know, I know that, like, groups like the Teachers Union has stepped up and said that they support Newsom, but, like, is this just coming from QAnon folks?
Yeah, it's really pushed from people on the far right, and also just people that were really angered by the way that Newsom handled the coronavirus pandemic. I don't agree that he handled it in a bad way, but they think that he handled it in a bad way, particularly like his business shutdowns. And more conservative-minded voters think that Newsom harmed the economy in some of these smaller counties, but I don't necessarily agree with that assessment. And then there's also a little bit of a push from the anti-defund the police people.
Okay.
Really, it's a move from QAnon, far-right leaning people.
I mean, from a teacher's perspective, when I looked into what he has done, he seemed like someone who should be popular with teachers. He proposed a new kindergarten level in this recent budget proposal, you know, basically like a K-1, K-2 situation, so kids get in earlier. He has forced regulation on charter schools, which is, you know, charter schools really got their start in California. And Dan and I have taught at a charter school, and we've seen how they can sometimes get away with things that, you know, traditional schools do not get away with. And I think some really like strict standards in terms of how things are done really would go a long way in preventing the types of things we see specifically at No Excuses schools, where I think sometimes the discipline comes down really heavy-handed from a mainly white staff to a mainly non-white student population. You know, and I think that in retrospect, as you said, his vaccination effort and his COVID handling was rather well coordinated for such a giant state. And, you know, just having that teachers union support should mean that, you know, this recall effort will fail miserably. Is that what people are thinking?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to go anywhere, really. I mean, anybody that's like to the left of like Ron Paul doesn't support it. What's funny too is I put out an episode talking about detailing the far right in California and what was behind the recall effort, and I actually received multiple messages from far right people saying like, "Oh, you got this all wrong. Like, this is a bipartisan effort. I know people on the left that support this." And I'm like, "Who are you talking to?" I'm like, "Yeah, your handful of anecdotes doesn't mean shit to me when it comes to actual data and statistics." March 2019, Newsom declared a moratorium on California's death penalty, preventing any executions within the state, so as long as he remained governor. So they eliminated the lethal injection program and closed the gas chamber at San Quentin State Prison that granted a reprieve for all 737 inmates on California's death row.
That's big. I like that move a lot.
That's the third largest death row in the Western Hemisphere, by the way.
Wow.
In March 2020, after the first coronavirus death was recorded in California, Gavin Newsom declared a state of emergency. Newsom also announced that mitigation policies for the state's estimated 108,000 unsheltered homeless people would be prioritized with a significant push to move them indoors. So, you know, that was a really good thing, obviously, but I found it kind of depressing, honestly, because I was like, really? It took a worldwide pandemic with millions of deaths for our leaders to act urgently in addressing California's homelessness crisis? So they were like, look, you know, homeless people might infect housed people with COVID. So we should take this seriously. It shouldn't have come to that, you know?
Yeah, that is a really good point. I did talk to Lauren Hubbard about the fact that his district has huge population of unhoused people. And I think that he's thinking really creatively about it. And also, he's ready to start a serious talk about housing first, which is kind of what you're describing. After the pandemic hit, Newsom adopted a housing first approach. But study after study, doctor after doctor who deals with the homeless or the unhoused will tell you that you really have to get someone into a real apartment, a real home that they can call their own before you can address all of the underlying causes. You think about it, it just makes sense. Like, you can't start getting therapy or treatment for a drug addiction or whatever it is. Like, you can't get a job if you don't have a stable place to sleep every night. So, like, putting someone in a stable shelter first really makes a ton of sense. And as Lauren Hubbard will share with us, it actually is cheaper for society to do it that way as well because of emergency room visits and other costs associated with the unhoused.
Absolutely.
I heard Lauren Hubbard talking about how his district was number one in the nation in terms of the unhoused population. How is that possible? Like, what is it about that community that makes it more vulnerable to homelessness?
If I had to guess, I would say that it's likely a result of it being predominantly an agricultural community. And I know with like agricultural jobs in California, oftentimes they're seasonal. So like workers will only work like 6 months out of the year. So I think that there's huge gaps in levels of employment and there's just tremendous levels of poverty. And it's probably like on a per capita basis.
Yeah, that makes sense. And Lauren Hubbard will talk about this as well in terms of how much of an effect it would have to have a system of immigration that actually worked, right? So that employers can't just threaten to call ICE anytime workers agitate for better pay, or in this case, potentially, you know, temporary housing for mm-hmm. seasonal workers, you know, any number of things that workers would normally just, you know, form a union or even just file a complaint. It's so much harder when you've always got that threat of having ICE show up and send you back.
Yeah, which is like why I never understand the argument from conservatives that immigrants are committing more crime. That doesn't make any sense. Why would they? They're always in fear of being deported.
Oh, no. Studies show time and time again that
Native-born Americans commit more crimes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And that just makes sense.
It seems to me like one of the issues that could unify Californians is the idea of like the long-term water shortage, because it seems like the fight, at least as I understand it, right now is sort of like a short-term, like survival-based strategy, as opposed to, I have not heard any 20, 30, 40-year strategy, because it seems like water is not going to be getting more plentiful over the next 50 years.
No, it's been a problem in California for over 150 years. Yeah, and it's only getting worse with the climate crisis.
Isn't that where a lot of the secessionist shit comes from, with like, if, you know, like the northern part of the state is in fact supplying a lot of the water.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah, because the north has most of the water and the resources, but the south has all the people. Yeah, that's why in Los Angeles, the leaders there have been saying for decades, we need to keep on growing. We need to keep on getting bigger, because more people is more political power.
Right. It's about influence. Like, hearkening back to that conversation with Rob Smith on the last episode, you know, you do end up having more sway in that case, especially in statewide politics. C-Money, you've been a little quiet here. I want to hear your take on some of these things.
You know, the thing I really liked about Lauren was the way he sidestepped the whole, like, culture war stuff. I mean, I feel like that's what Nunes does, is he weaponizes culture war stuff. Everything he doesn't like is socialism, and, you know, big government is socialism. And I really like that Lauren just didn't pick up that ball and run with it at all. You know, he brought up some of the difficulties the squad has had in seeing their influence go beyond kind of bigger statements. For me, I just like that he, you know, starting out as a Republican and then finding his way to more progressive politics, he really kind of illustrated how you can be a socialist and be fiscally conservative. And socialism doesn't mean more government. It means using the state apparatus in whatever form to serve the needs of the many, even if it means ending funding for programs that don't work or redundant or outdated. And, you know, I just think it's a big misconception. I think he went a long way to just kind of dispelling it. And I think that an approach like that could really work effectively for a lot of progressives, lib left, stuff like that, in approaching moderate and conservative types more than the culture war stuff. I was just really impressed by that.
Yeah, he's so reasonable, you know, and so measured in his responses. That's a great point. Like, even questions like, so
how about water pipes?
Yeah.
Like, Lauren Hubbard was talking about that. Absolutely. Fix the fucking pipes, bro.
Yeah, figure out a system to make sure that the people in California don't live in drought at this point, like, forever.
Yeah, there are thousands of Californians that live in developing world conditions.
In terms of access to clean water, you mean?
Yeah, in terms of access to clean water and just housing conditions in general.
Wow. And still, Devin Nunes spends his time going after the Twitter account, Devin Nunes's Cow.
Wait, Devin Nunes has a cow?
No, but there's a Twitter handle, Devin Nunes.
Sorry, my ADD just kicked in. I was like, yeah, water for everybody. Wait, Devin Nunes has a cow?
Yeah, I mean,
that's amazing. I want to hear more.
He did grow up as a dairy farmer, but he made so many references to it that someone set up an account to mock him called Devin Nunes's Cow on Twitter, and it gained so many followers so fast, and started to say some things that Devin didn't like, and so he actually filed a lawsuit to try to shut the account down.
So basically what you're saying is he has a Twitter account and he has an utter one.
Oh, wow. That hurts my heart. That hurts my heart.
Dad/teacher slam.
Yeah, that was That was a dad joke.
It's coming in hot.
So, folks, you've heard us talking about this interview long enough. Let's go ahead and cut to the interview. Lauren Hubbard, running for California's 22nd district, would eventually go up against Devin Nunes if he wins the nomination. Our guest this week is Lauren Hubbard, running for U.S. Congress in California's 22nd district. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Mr. Hubbard. I'm excited to have you on the show.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here. I'm a big fan of the show. I like the whole concept of defanging the term socialism.
Could you start off by going ahead and introducing yourself to our listeners? So, like, what's your background and why have you chosen to run for Congress?
Absolutely. So I am a son of a single working class mother. And I always like to point it out that, you know, she was a woman who worked multiple jobs, but still needed food stamps to make ends meet for us. It was just me and my sister growing up. And, you know, I worked hard. I got into college here in the district. I went to Fresno State, graduated with a degree in political science. It was in my junior year of college that my mother passed away from a totally preventable thing. She had hypertension, and instead of using her insurance to pay for prescriptions, her health insurance didn't cover her prescription. So she decided, well, you know, I could do okay, decided not to pay for prescriptions and use that money towards other things like bills and other stuff that she had going on. And it ultimately cost her life. She passed away in my junior year at Fresno State, and I decided to change from history to political science and really get into public service after that. So my entire professional career after graduation has been serving the community. So I started out as a benefits worker for the Department of Social Services here, where I got to help people get connected to cash aid, temporary job placements, and Medi-Cal, which is our state of California's Medicaid program, and food stamps, SNAP benefits. And from that, I moved over to pensions. So I was a pension analyst for the state of California. And as a retirement counselor, I got to talk with people about retirement readiness, got to help them prepare for retirement, as far as what goes into thinking about it, coordinating with Social Security, coordinating with Medicare, making sure that you have health benefits at retirement. That was one of the things that was really eye-opening to me, is in the 5 years that I did that, I got the opportunity to talk to thousands of people, and not a single one felt they had saved enough for retirement. I was talking to people that had million plus in the bank, in a retirement account, and still not being able to afford retirement, not because of the money necessarily for those folks, but because their job, when they retire, they'd have to pay for health insurance. And they already had pre-existing conditions. They did not know that they would be able to afford the health insurance, and that gap from retiring at 60 to Medicare picking up at 65. Wow. You had to think to myself, oh my gosh, you have $1 million. That is your concern, but it is for tons and tons of people. Currently, I am an operations manager at the Water Resources Control Board. So I am on the front lines of conservation efforts, particularly with water in California, in the Central Valley. In particular, water and water resources is a big issue. We just got out of a drought, a five-year drought, 2 years ago, and we're smack in the middle of another one. We haven't really built up the resources to go through another five-year period like we did. So I'm working on efforts to prepare not only our residents, but also our agricultural community to deal with that loss of water. So I work with family farms combating drought. It's one of the things that I got into. It was one of the things I was like interested in. And now that I'm in it right now, I can't tell you how difficult water is in California in particular, especially with dealing with all these individual water districts that run through California. Los Angeles takes up a lot of water. It has no water of its own. So we have a whole bunch of aqueducts and water projects just to bring water to Los Angeles. But in the aggregate, there's all these outlying communities that don't get access to that water. Like the California Aqueduct runs straight across through the state. We don't get any of that water.
Wow.
And so it's been really interesting talking to all these stakeholders who and community members who are trying to get a resource that we take for granted. You know, I'm able to turn on the faucet and get clean water. You know, a couple of years ago, 2016, the big issue was Flint, Michigan. I'm dealing with communities in California that have the same issue where the water is contaminated and they turn on their faucet, can't use it. So they got to truck in water. Wow. I've seen classrooms that have just jugs of water along the side of the classroom wall because the students need it to eat and wash and do all kinds of stuff. And it's been very interesting, to say the least.
Sure. And so that kind of has motivated you to get into Congress to see
that. Yeah, that's one of the primary factors. My professional experience has been one of the primary factors. Another factor is, you know, I'm just not feeling represented. We have a representative now, Devin Nunes, and I'm sure we're going to talk about him, who is really kind of turned into a Trump lackey. And if it doesn't have to do with Trump, he pays no mind to it. So these are issues that I'm dealing with now in my as manager at the Water Board, where he has been the representative in this area for 20 plus years and done nothing about. Mm-hmm. The big issue for me, you know, I was one of these people that was had my head down and just thought I could work in the community and that I could make a difference there. And then, you know, 2016 presidential election happens, you know, Bernie Sanders comes out. And he's actually talking about things I care about and things that like just make sense. And that was like one of the wake up calls to say, you know what, we need regular people to be in office that understand these issues and can work to solve these issues. You know, the district that I'm from is traditionally a conservative district. And, you know, I'm not ashamed to say I grew up being a Republican. The first election I could vote for was 2008, and I was a registered Republican. And it's funny now, but I voted for Rudy Giuliani in the primary.
Wow,
2008! What a 180 to now.
Right. I mean, he had not devolved into the character he is today at that point.
No, he was America's mayor.
Right, right, right.
I mean, outside of New York, I'm sure New York kind of knew. But the rest of us, he was the mayor of 9/11, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I come at these problems and thinking in terms of this like conservative mindset, to where it is, I always have these friends that tell me like, oh, you know, I'm socially liberal, but fiscally conservative. And that's the kind of lens that I come at to these issues. So like Medicare for All, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, that is a fiscal issue for me because it saves us money.
Right, right.
And so I have this like, you know, my wife is a registered nurse and she's very empathetic. And so she has that liberal heart, as we like to call it. And I have a little bit of that. So I care about what happens to people. Mm-hmm. And I want everyone to be successful and really expand those opportunities. But I also support these ideas and these policies because they make sense.
Sure. Thank you. That was a great explanation of your background and your reason for running. So one thing I always love to check with the candidate on, because of the problem that I have with big money in politics, is are you a grassroots candidate? Are you refusing big corporate donations?
Yes. Yes, we are 100% grassroots. you know, for the obvious reasons of big money is not really going to give money to me with the policies that I have. But I also don't like to be, you know, beholden to someone. That's one of the things I think Donald Trump was really successful at getting people to pay attention to when he would say, you know, I give money to Democrats and I give money to Republicans. And guess what? They answer the phone when I call.
Right.
You know, I don't want anything like that kind of hanging over my head. I want people to know that when I get into office, I got there with their help. So I am 100% for them.
Right. And Bernie, you know, you mentioned Bernie. He proved that it can be done with the right energy from small donations from individuals. So the other thing I love to look at with candidates is do they support the big progressive programs? You've already addressed the fact that you do. So, you know, we had a quick exchange on Twitter a few days ago, and you really wrote something that was profound about why you're in favor of going big and kind of how these things interconnect. So could you tell us about the homelessness in your district and how you think that relates to many of the policy proposals that progressives tend to support, like universal basic income, Medicare for all, and other big ideas?
Within my district, we have Tulare County. In 2020, it was ranked number one in the nation for the highest unsheltered homeless population. That is embarrassing. That's not something we're going to go out and chanting. We're number one, mm-hmm. number one in. And I think that, you know, breaking down this problem of our unhoused community is really A, for the people that care about other people. We don't want to have people out on the street. This is America. You know, a large percentage of our unhoused population are veterans. They've served this country. You know, they deserve to have a place to live. But also just being a human being, you deserve to have a place to live where you can feel safe. One of the things I like to do when I talk about this issue is kind of breaking it down for people so they can understand just the scale of the problem. At any given moment in the United States, 500,000 people are experiencing homelessness in any given night. Over the course of a year, 3.5 million people will have been homeless in the United States. In our home, our unhoused population, I'm trying to correct my vocabulary. So we're so used to saying homeless, but unhoused is the lens to look at it from. Our unhoused population can be broken down into three categories. There's the temporarily unsheltered, which makes up about 75% of people. Another 10% are episodically homeless, so they go through periods of homelessness. And then there's the chronic homeless, which makes up about 15%. It is the chronically homeless people, unhoused people, that use a majority of the resources that the government sets aside for this issue. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 60% of those resources. Thinking at it again from a conservative lens, when you have an issue like this with chronically homeless and they're using this many resources, to put a dollar amount on it, it's about $25,000 to $45,000 that the government spends per person per year on emergency room visits, on policing and things like that. That's the cost to the taxpayer. $50,000 per person per year, that's a lot of money when we can build housing and we could have a federal jobs program to put people to work to build housing.
Right.
So not only are you getting people to be involved in building the housing that they're going to live in, but we're turning around, we're paying them for it. And there's a buy-in there. When it comes to that cost for emergency room visits, that is something, obviously, an unhoused person usually isn't going to have health insurance, isn't going to be able to pay for that. What a lot of people miss in the debate that I always hear about is, well, I don't want to pay for someone else's health insurance. You must not know how insurance works currently, because that's exactly what you're doing. They just don't tell you about it. So wouldn't you rather know and upfront and control that cost that you're going to pay either way? Mm-hmm. So that's another thing that that'll curb costs is having a Medicare for all system will curb that cost. Another thing that the intersectionality of this is that, you know, housing justice is really one of those things that cuts across race and income barriers, because a lot of people think that homeless, unhoused people are a minority, and they did something wrong to get them on the streets.
Right.
When really, in America, a lot of, not a lot, but about 5% of people on the previous year that are that experienced homelessness previously had an income of $50,000 or more.
Oh, wow.
So you, if you lose that job, that's the slippery slope from temporary homelessness to the chronic, is if you had a job, you lose that job. For a while, you're in this mental space of, oh, I'll get another one. And then after 3 weeks, if you don't get another one, that self-doubt starts to creep in that, oh, I'll never get another job. And that's how people slide into that chronic homelessness. So, yeah, all these issues are really kind of woven together.
Sure. And you kind of, you didn't name it this way, but one of the ways I've heard this called is by naming it housing first, right? Before anything else happens, we get them housed. And it's a concept that's gained momentum in recent years. And I've heard doctors speak out about this who say it really is it's a healthcare issue because you can't, you know, as you mentioned, the emergency room visits, you can't treat someone's chronic health conditions if they're, you know, not in a stable place to sleep each night. But it relates to mental health and addiction treatment of chronic illnesses. And, you know, you can't get ready for a job or go to a job interview as easily right off the street.
Exactly.
So why do you think there is so much hesitation despite, you know, doctors speaking out about it and experts saying that this is the best approach, you know, for some type of housing first program?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, as we've saw this past year, people don't really, I don't know, for whatever reason, they have their own opinions and they know better than the medical professionals that are giving us this advice. My wife has done work with needle exchange programs, and she's always telling me about you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And traditionally, we've seen governments take this conservative viewpoint that someone is you know, homeless because of something they did, or you know, they're on drugs, so that's a personal choice that they're making, and coming at it from that point of view. And that's, you know, one of the things I personally thought, I was in eighth grade, you know, that I would see a homeless person and think, oh, they must have did something to be homeless. It wasn't until I got a little bit older and understood how the process of how it can happen. But the Housing First model is one of the things that's being adapted more and more. And it's being adapted that way because of the success rates. So you look at the state of Utah, for example, adopted a housing first model, and they were able to get their chronic homeless population cleared up. 91% now of the homeless population that were previously homeless are now housed. We would think of that as you know, tremendous, but getting people housing first is regardless of their issues with substance abuse, addiction, we got to get them housed first. And you know, it's been my experience that having on-site social programs, not forcing people to go to them, but just having them there, we need to build trust with these people. You know, one of my good friends just did a ride. She just rode her bike from San Francisco to Los Angeles, 470 miles.
Wow.
To bring awareness to the sanitation issue of the unhoused community. So she was raising money for that. And then talking with her, I'm finding out about all these things, like, you know, with shelters, you have to in order to get into a shelter, you know, they got to make sure that you're clean first before they'll give you a bed. And, you know, you have to do all this stuff, these addiction classes and things to get housing. A lot of families are broken up because a lot of shelters are for women and children. So the men have to separate from their families. And she was telling me all this story. She used to be unhoused and is now on her feet and is doing incredible things. But getting that trust, is, she says, is the number one issue. Mm-hmm. Not forcing people to do things. Let them come to you. They'll want to get clean once they've built that trust. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of governments have that conservative view where they're looking at a situation and say, we need to have this done before we get these people any help. But as my wife reminds me, that Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I can't address this issue until I've addressed the baseline one. If I don't know where I'm going to sleep tonight or what I'm going to eat tonight, I can't worry about another problem that's face down the road.
Right. That's a great way of explaining it. I like that. So where do you stand on the concept of defunding the police? You know, a conversation that has grown out of the murder of George Floyd. Looking critically at police budgets and allocating some of that money to programs that would meet other glaring gaps, like mental health counselors equipped to be first responders when someone calls 911 about an acute issue that's caused by someone who is, you know, having a mental health crisis, or, you know, other programs in the community. Where do you stand with this debate?
You know, I'm part of this racial equity working group that is that started at the Central Valley Water Board or the State Water Board to bring awareness to racial equity issues. And one of the things that I found in doing this work is we need to have better marketing. I think we'd have a lot more buy-in if we didn't call it defunding the police.
Yep.
You know, I was reading a statistic somewhere that, you know, support for like Black Lives Matter has decreased over the year since George Floyd happened, and since he passed away, it was at its height, and it subsequently has gone downhill. So I think we just need to have better marketing. Obviously, it is true that we need to look at, again, from my conservative lens, we need to look at how much money is being spent on policing and what are we getting for that. Fresno in particular, where I'm from, the police take up more than half of the city's budget.
Wow.
So if more than 50 cents of every dollar is being taken up by police, and we have an issue like last year, 2020, where we had 724 shootings happen and more than twice the previous year, and we gave you an extra $10 million towards your budget. Wow. I think maybe we need to look at the income, about the outcomes of that. We're giving you more money, but the situation is not getting better. Let's look at where we can get better outcome for our money. You know, earlier this year, the city had a settlement for a wrongful death involving the police, and they're paying a family $4.4 million. Something like $21 million has been paid out from the city towards wrongful death suits from police deaths since 2010. Wow. Like factors in to be like over $2 million a year just paying people for people that police have killed.
Yeah.
That money could definitely be turned around and spent in programs. We have a lot of community-based programs that could use that funding and probably get a better outcome. Advanced Peace is one of those community groups that's here and based in Fresno. And, you know, they're taking the time to invest time, energy, and resources in finding alternatives for people that are in these at-risk communities. You know, gang prevention is one of those things that's shown that it does work when it's community-based. A lot of people forget that the police, 9 out of 10 calls that the police respond to are nonviolent. And then that's not to say they can't escalate into violence, but, you know, sometimes their presence alone does escalate it into a violent situation.
Yeah.
The police are responding to calls for, like, you know, the cliche cat stuck in a tree call.
Yeah.
And things like that. We could better focus our resources. And so the police are handling issues that they're equipped to. Police, they're primarily trained in use of force.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can have them just go out to those situations, we would probably have better outcomes and lower budget that saves us money that we could put towards reinvest back into the community. Talk about the cross section between mental health, addiction, and homelessness. Those police dollars. You know, we're having police respond to a lot of these calls that mental health professionals are better equipped to respond to. We have just now, within the last probably 3-4 years, started looking at addiction as a health issue. That's one of the things that we need to have investment in. Police responding to these calls to tear down these temporary housing that is set up because, you know, people have nowhere else to go. You know, if we switched to this housing first model, that would decrease these run-ins between our unhoused community and police. It would decrease that recidivism rate for people that are chronically homeless. Like we were talking about, all these things are interconnected. But yeah, just like you were saying, I think we just need to have better marketing. Defund the police sounds cool, but nobody I've ever talked to wants to actually abolish the police. Because they still, you know, we still need a police force to do the work that they were originally intended. Well, I won't say originally intended, work that we need them to do.
Yes.
To stop violent crime. Violent crime is the issue.
Yes, that makes sense. So if it's like fund the social workers as opposed to defund, positively framed, right?
Yes, that's where I'm at. Like, yes, we need. I've worked closely with a whole bunch of social workers in my professional capacity. You have to love that work in order to do it. And if we could make it a more attractive by investing more resources to it, either paying a higher wage and getting them the support that they need to do that work, I think we would have better outcomes. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm coming from a position, a mindset that, you know, if we do the same thing over and over again and expect a different result is the definition of insanity. Sure. So we, for 50, 60, 70 years, have done policing this way and asked them to do more and more. Hey, why don't we turn that around and see what, you know, if we do this investment down the road, let's take make it a four-year plan. Let's do this investment here, go back and look at what the data tells us, and then, you know, make the change. If it's positive change, hey, great. Let's try to expand that, incorporate that more in more places. If it doesn't work and we're seeing an increase in violent crime and all this other stuff, that didn't work. We're back to the drawing board, and we can just, you know, just as easily flip those budgets around back to what it was. That's where I stand on that issue.
Yeah, I think that's a really honest response too. So I didn't really want to give much airtime to talking about, the person I hope you're facing off against if you win the Democratic nomination, but Devin Nunes. So I think we do need to address some things. First of all, what is the effect on people in your district when they see or hear, you know, their own representative peddling QAnon theories? And also the other part of that is, like, what do the voters in your district who voted for him, what do they see in him? What do you think is, like, you know, you have this conservative lens. What are they seeing in him?
You know, this is something that's kind of really personal, actually. My in-laws are very conservative. This past year with the QAnon conspiracies and things like that. I don't know. I hope my wife doesn't get upset with me. Her mother was really influenced by the QAnon thing. And it had an effect on our relationship where she wanted to save us from what she was believing was actually happening in the world. And you know, it's easy to sit back and think, oh, these people are crazy and this and that. But when it's someone that you know and that you love, you just really want to help them. Mm-hmm. And it's so neurological that, you know, this thing is in their brain and they think it's this way. And you know, we just got back to a situation where, you know, we were going to family events and stuff like that again together. It was a long five months, almost a year since the election, because, you know, we voted for Joe Biden. And that was like the absolute worst. But I think that once you get to talking to these people, especially when they're your family, and let them know, hey, we might not agree on this, but I still care about you, and still making that effort to reach out, that those ties that you had before QAnon will resurface. We just got to a point where, you know, it was we started doing things around the grandkids, so our kids, and say, hey, you know, they miss Nana, and hey, let's just go to the park and this and that. and doing non-politics related things. And then once the conversation went there, to say, oh, you know, I don't really feel like talking about that. But hey, did you see the Lakers lost last night?
right.
You know, things like that. When I talk to people in the district about Devin Nunes in particular, I always hear that, you know, he's got my back. He's got my support. I support him because I know he's working for me. And when I like do a little probing and say like, oh, well, what is it that he's done for you specifically that he's done for you as a policy? Because I know when I talk to my ag friends, it's always about water, but he hasn't done a single thing for that.
Right.
He might have been a farmer at one time, but he's, you know, suing cows on the internet. He's not really getting his hands dirty anymore, you know? So I don't know how to get past that other than to highlight, hey, you know, you might think he's for you, but here's where he's actually at. Here's what he's actually done for you. Absolutely nothing. But call all these programs and things that will benefit you socialism. And I've tried to get into, again, going back to that conservative mindset, I've tried to get into this place where I love talking to people who disagree with me. It is always been this thing that I do since a little kid. So I love talking to people who disagree with me and trying to get into their head, in this headspace. And I've discovered that, you know, we always talk about that Kansas problem. What's the matter with Kansas? Why do they always vote for things that don't benefit them?
Yeah.
And it's this discovery that people, my conservative friends, put their values above any monetary benefit. And so, like, the value of independence and free thought and freedom of speech, the value of what they pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Those are things that they value. And I'm trying to get that lens to where I can to begin to talk to them from a values-based point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And have that value of connection. One of the things I think is, you know, one of the reasons I decided to stay in the community that I'm in is growing up, I always thought I was from a small town because, you know, anything to do with agriculture is seen as like rural, small town. So I used to tell people I'm from a small town. Until I actually started getting around and going to different states and talking to people who were from actually small towns. And we would like talk about stuff and like, oh, how many people are in your town? Oh, you know, I'm from a small town. Oh, me too. How many? Oh, about 400, 500 people live there. And I was just like, oh, well, we got about 500,000. But it's that sense of the community is what really makes that small town feel. One of the things that I love and one of the things that is a value that connects me with these conservative folks to say like, hey, I know that we have a difference in political opinions, but I know I'm willing to bet that you care about your neighbor just like I care about my neighbor. And that's what connects us. And then going through and talking to these people from a value-based perspective about why Medicare for All is good and why we need a federal jobs program, why a Green New Deal is something that we need to support. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about. And my thing with Democrats in general is we've kind of abandoned communities like this. I was on another podcast talking about how Democrats, if it's like the small town feel, if they've lost an election here, it's kind of like, well, we'll move on to somewhere else. Right. Not, hey, let's look at why we lost and let's go and do some real deep digging and find out what the people in this community are like and what where they come from. I don't know if it's like too hard for them to do or they just don't want to spend the money to do it. But I always thought back. I remember when Obama won in 2012. That was the first time I remember it. And Republicans were going to go there, have this retreat where they went back. They went through all the things that happened in that 2012 election. How can we win? How can we get these the support and things like that? And then, you know, we had that 2008 election brought in Democrats into power in the House, in the mm-hmm. Senate, and in the presidency.
Yeah,
we could have did a lot of good with that. We almost had a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate.
Yep.
Fast forward to today, where the Democrats are again in control of the House, the Senate, and the presidency, we get hung up by these, no polite way to call them, but these other Democrats who yeah. who say, no, we can't end the filibuster because it's not fair, or no, we can't have a $15 minimum wage because it's not part of a clean bill, and all these things. And I'm just thinking of as a when I was a non-political person and thinking back on what happened to Obama in his first term and waiting a whole year for Republican support that never came, that said, right. Oh, yeah, well, yeah, we like to see bipartisanship and we'll work with you. And it never came.
Yep.
And because of that, you know, people lost confidence in him,
yep.
lost confidence in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
And I think into today, hey, the same thing is kind of happening. I have no doubt in my mind, as soon as Republicans win control of the Senate, that they will end the filibuster and start doing all these things because they don't care.
No, they don't. They don't play the same game. That's
we
absolutely
put
right.
these constrictions on ourselves for whatever reasons. Mitch McConnell kept a Supreme Court seat open for almost a whole year. Yep. He just made up the reason why. And Democrats rolled over. They didn't file. Oh, this is not right. That's all they said. They didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't go out and make the argument. They don't. We don't have a great messaging arm.
No.
To go out there and say, yes, we are fighting for real people, and it's these things.
Yep.
And then actually follow through and do it.
Right.
And so that reputation of the Democratic Party is building here, but it is. We need some help from the national party to come yep. in and say, hey, let's invest some resources and get this going here, because this is a completely winnable seat.
Yeah. And I think that relates to one of my questions about, you know, we had Chuck Rocha on, who was a former Bernie Sanders campaign staffer. He ran the Latino outreach and he talked a lot about what you're describing, but more specifically for the Latino community. But he talked about the fact that, you know, he had the Latino campaign embedded within the campaign. It wasn't a separate thing. But getting into communities and just having community meetings, you know, for him, it was finding a native speaker who the community members could really relate to. But it's the same thing you're talking about. You know, it's getting in there and getting that message across, but also listening to people. You know, I just with that question, I kind of wanted to get your sense. You know, you have a large, I think it's about 40% of your district is Hispanic. What's your plan in terms of how to connect with those voters?
You know, one of the things I think that people forget, this is my first time running for office. And so the consultant side of things is one thing that's interesting. And I think people think, oh, my consultants, they know what to do to handle this demographic and this demographic. And, you know, once we get the money up, we'll talk to them about this. But realizing that you do need a native speaker, because Google Translate, not that great.
No.
And building in from the campaign from the beginning, having people that's on your, like on your campaign chairs, one of the people that's working with my campaign is from these small town communities where people don't speak English at all. That's one of the things I think you need to have as a person that is on your team that knows the community, that has a buy-in with them already. Again, just like with the working with the unhoused community, the trust. So they want to know that you are there for them and you're listening to their concerns. You know, one of the skills I pride myself on is reflective learning, where I'm able to talk to people and get their point of views, but then have that communication skill to reflect to them that I've understood what they've said and that I'll work for that. Mm-hmm. So our campaign is really, you know, we're going to be focused on doing a lot of like outreach that is very poor people's campaignish, where we're stopping off in a lot of places, getting on the truck bed and just talking to people that are there. And that person to person outreach is invaluable. And that's things with when people have a lot of money that they overlook. Is yeah, money can buy you ads and it can buy, you know, airtime and this and that, but that personal connection, that one-on-one to say I've looked this person in the eyes and I know they're going to fight for me, is something money doesn't buy. And then that's one of the things that our campaign is focused on doing.
Right. So your district, Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, produces the majority of the food that's produced in California.
In the world,
right.
In the country. Yeah.
Yes, in the country and in the world as well. So when I, you know, read that in preparation for the interview, my mind goes, you know, to all the learning and studying I've done about Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, you know, his long struggle for justice. And to my knowledge, farm workers, especially seasonal farm workers, are still not making a living wage or getting fairly compensated for the really hard work they do. What do you think can be done? What would a strong federal minimum wage address the issue? You know, what's your position on that?
So I think that, you know, this is coming from a point of view where, you know, my summer job was at Sun World, which is a packing agricultural company in Bakersfield. And when it comes to paying farm labor, labor is the majority of the cost for these producers. So they an increase in minimum wage, they're just to a producer that's already on the margins. You know, what's going to happen is, well, I can't afford it, so I'm going to hire less people. And that's kind of the trade-off that you get in that situation. What I think, and this is the part of it that is talking about that interconnectivity. If we had like Medicare for all, where these people were able to have health insurance and health insurance not be a part of the employer cost that goes to that overhead.
Yeah.
That could be a situation where I am able to increase the pay to our migrant farm workers. Another thing that would make it a lot easier is an immigration system that actually worked.
Yeah.
You know, California, we used to be like the pride of immigration because in the 80s, it's funny, Ronald Reagan in the 80s or pre-80s, when he was the governor of California, we used to have a border where migrant workers could come up, do their work, and go back home.
Uh-huh.
Come in seasonally, send money home, and then go back home.
Yeah.
Now with the situation, a lot of – and this is kind of how I knew that conservatives were not really genuinely interested in fixing immigration, because we could have immigration be zero – if we made it absolutely illegal for companies to hire undocumented people.
Yeah.
But that's not the case. Donald Trump had all kinds of undocumented workers. Devin Nunes himself on his family's farm in Iowa has undocumented workers.
Yeah.
So that's not an issue that they're really concerned with. It was the brown people. But, you know, that's the thing that would really help if we could have an immigration system where people weren't afraid of someone finding their immigration status, where they could be a voice, have a voice to stand up and say, hey, we are treated unfair, and have that collective bargaining ability.
Yeah.
And truly not fear the repercussions of, okay, you want to collectively bargain. I just happen to call Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they're going to be here at your meeting.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
So that is something that would really, really help the situation as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you know, I see it with parents of a lot of my students are from Central America, either born there or born of parents who came here and are undocumented. And there's a lot that they can't do in the community because of that fear. That's a great point.
Yeah. One of my really good friends, his parents were undocumented, and he was undocumented himself. He's a DACA recipient, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. He came to the United States when he was 6. We need to protect these people. That fear of coming home and finding, oh, my parents got picked up, they're not here anymore, is devastating if as a child.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even more so as an adult with that looming over your head.
So, yeah, we saw in the 2020 census a declining birth rate, and, immigration, having a functional immigration system would be a great way to fix that issue as well, and make sure that we are not, an aging population with no younger people to pay for it.
Yeah, look at China. They just expanded their child rule. They had that one child rule, and now you could have three. But, the social engineering has already been done. They're going to have a way older population than the one that is working to replace it. It'll be interesting in 20 years when that, starts to really take effect on if that is sustainable for them. I'd be interested to find out.
Right. So a lot of attention from the left, especially the online left, is on the Squad and other progressive members of the House who were elected on promises to fight for, the transformational programs we've talked about, like Medicare for All, Green New Deal. Now, I kind of get the frustration from voters who want to see more, but I also try to constantly remind people that the Tea Party was not really a disruptive force until they were above that, at least 40, 50 members in the House. What else do you think needs to happen? Like, so if we got 50 members who joined the Progressive Caucus before we can actually see them wielding real power in Washington?
Yeah, I think that, influence, leadership is influence, right? So getting into these positions, I'm of the mind that Nancy Pelosi is probably going to retire pretty soon. I would think like Dianne Feinstein's going to be retired pretty soon. I don't know. I think she's got 4 years left on her term or something like that. But we do have these conservative Democrats, and that's part of the issue, I think, with the Democratic Party, with political parties in general, really, is, they're these big tents, and we want to have as many people in the tent as possible. And we live in the United States where you only get two choices. So we look at the other side who used to be conservative, but not really anymore. It's just a party of Trump. They have no platform. They have no any kind of policy other than obstructionism and no. And then you have Democrats, and you have these wings of the Democratic Party that are progressive and, are of the mind that the Democratic Party should stand for programs like Medicare for All, like universal basic income, like universal tuition, tuition, public free college, public tuition free public college, rather, those types of programs. And then you have these like traditional Democrats who are just, well, we're not Republicans, but we don't really, we're not comfortable with giving lip service to those programs. I'm of the mind that we are where the American people are on the progressive side, and that we just need to put our money where our mouth is and get the support from the people to put more of us in Congress. So just like you were saying, once we have those numbers, then we can pull these, I'll call them traditional Democrats, into our way of thinking. What, 'cause this is what I've gathered from a whole lot of politicians, people that are genuine politicians, is they want to stay in office.
Yep.
Very rarely do you have these like George Washington-esque, well, I was here to serve this purpose and it's done, so I excuse myself. Once you get there, you want to stay there. And yeah. So, you know, it, you don't have to be like the greatest politician to see the writing on the wall that if all these programs are popular and that popularity is translated into votes, oh, well, hey, I got to be there. Because right now, this is with the whole Medicare for All thing, the vote that they wanted to put up, all I see, saw it as was lip service.
Yep.
That's all it was. Just like the Green New Deal. People that say, oh, I'm for the Green New Deal, and yeah, I'm with the resolution for it, but don't have any plans to implement any parts about it, you know. That it's just, I just check the box for the litmus test so I can be considered progressive, so I don't get attacked from the left for it. Mm-hmm. Those kind of things are need to go. We just need to have the American people that are with us on issues like Medicare for All, where even Fox News viewers, 70% of people that watch Fox News want a single payer healthcare system.
Right.
We can make hay with that.
Yeah.
People that are on our side with public colleges and trade schools, we can make hay with that. Mm-hmm. We just need to go out, market it better, get those votes, get our people elected. That will bring them in because they're all about their survival, perpetuating their survival. That will translate them into moving over to our side, and we will get these things done. You know, we had talked a little bit about, you know, Black Panthers and the Black Panther Party. And one of the things that I wanted to kind of say on air about that was the ability for people to understand and get people. You had Black people, you had Hispanic people, you had people who we would call white nationalists today, all under the umbrella of the Black Panther Party when it comes to economic issues. Mm-hmm. And so I talked to a lot of Black people who like didn't like Bernie Sanders because he wouldn't recognize race. Mm-hmm. And like, well, that's your opinion, but what he was talking about and the economic opportunities and bringing those in intersectionalized race. Mm-hmm. Intersex race. So we can win on that message anywhere in the country. Right. We just have to unite behind it.
That's a great point. So our listenership seems to be very politically engaged, and many want to help candidates like you to get in office and start making the moves that we talked about in this conversation. How can they support you? How can they find you?
Well, they can go to www.lornhubbard.com. That's Lorne, Lourin, Hubbard, Hubbard. We are having a campaign kickoff event on Juneteenth. So if they are in California and they want to come out, go to one of the few Black-owned breweries, not only in California, but in the country. That's where we're having our kickoff event, and information is available on the website. It's going to be a great event. Got speakers lined up. Yours truly, of course, will be talking. Yeah, the website's a good place to start.
And your Twitter handle.
I was just about to say that. And I'm on social media as well, with on Twitter at Lauren Hubbard, and Facebook, facebook.com/Lauren for Congress.
And I'll have these links in the show notes, in the episode notes, when folks click on the episode. Mr. Hubbard, I really appreciate you taking the time on a Friday afternoon to chat with me. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was good. It was good. I enjoyed it.
Wish you luck in your race.
Thank you. You guys have a good one.
Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message. That's 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.